Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход». В том подъезде, как в поместье, проживает черный кот. Он в усы усмешку прячет, темнота ему как щит. Все коты поют и плачут.
Hello, world. How are you? Welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Every week we pick a new book on Russia or Eurasia and talk to the author. This week it's my pleasure to present an interview with Miriam Dobson on her book Khrushchev's Cold Summer, Gulag Returnees, Crime, and the Fate of Reform After Stalin. Of the many topics in Russian history, the Gulag stands near the top of the list. Every student of Russia will at some point read the works of Solzhenitsyn, Ginsberg, and Shalamov for a thorough picture of the injustice and horror of the Soviet Gulag system. Less, however, is known about the fate of the Gulag after Stalin, and in particular, the social and cultural response to the release of over 4 million prisoners after his death in 1953. Thanks to Khrushchev's Cold Summer, we now have a good sense of this. There are a lot of things to like about this book: its ability to capture the voice of Soviet citizens through letters and petitions, the moral panics around crime and Gulag subculture, and the attempts by Khrushchev to construct a post-Stalin political narrative. But what I particularly appreciate is how Khrushchev's Cold Summer emphasizes that Stalin's death did not produce a collective sigh of relief, but a great amount of social anxiety and confusion that was exemplified in how Soviet society made sense of the Gulag returnee and his legacies. So without further delay, here's my interview with Miriam. Enjoy. Hi, Miriam.
Hi, Sean.
Welcome to New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. Thank you for taking the time to talk about your book, Khrushchev's Cold Summer, Gulag Returnees, Crime, and the Fate of Reform After Stalin. Just to begin, tell us a bit about yourself and why you chose to study the history of Soviet Russia, and in particular, the post-war period.
Well, I guess as a teenager, the thing that I found most exciting at school was always foreign languages, and I studied French and Spanish. And then when I was looking to apply to university, I felt that I wanted to try something new. So I ended up taking Russian as a beginner. And I guess I'd always had an interest in Russian literature. I'd liked reading Anna Karenina and various other things as a teenager. And then when I got to university, I found that it was particularly Russian history rather than really literature that excited me the most. And particularly in my final year, I had a really inspirational teacher, Chris Ward, who taught us courses on 19th and 20th century Soviet history. And I think it was really that made me feel that I wanted to go on to postgraduate study at all, and particularly to Russian history. So after finishing my degree, my first degree, I went to London to the School of Slavonic and Eastern European Studies, where I took an MA in history, and again had a really good teacher, Susan Morrissey, who taught a Soviet history course. And from there, I started thinking that I wanted to go on and do a PhD in some area of Soviet history, but really kind of found lots of things that I was reading interesting and exciting, and didn't have a very clear idea of exactly what I wanted to work on. And I guess I started to think about what areas were perhaps kind of open to new work, and it seemed to me that the Stalinist era, there'd been lots of really great work done in the 90s, and that perhaps the post-war period, and particularly the post-Stalin period, were areas which hadn't really been touched upon so much. There'd been work kind of by earlier generations on political science and on literature, but really it seemed a little bit that the kind of 50s and 60s were still a very much an open field, and that in some ways there'd be more freedom as a young scholar coming in to be able to choose a topic and work on it. And I guess also I felt that there were lots of interesting questions that had been raised by the study of the 1930s about the nature of Soviet society, which would be interesting to explore in terms of what was Stalinist, what was Soviet, how did things change once Stalin died in 1953. So it was at that point I started looking around and kind of thinking about what topics would work for a PhD in the Khrushchev era, having particular interest, I guess, in the kind of social, cultural history approaches.
And why did you choose to work on Gulag returnees? What interests you in this? And how did you come to write this book in particular?
Well, I guess as I was doing my MA, at one point I read Grossman's Forever Flowing about the experiences, a fictional work, but about a Gulag returnee, and the problems of a kind of a family responding to his return. And that started making me think that this was potentially an interesting topic to work on. I guess as I was starting the project, I thought it would be primarily about political returnees, because that was what was mentioned in the kind of the secondary works on the Khrushchev period. Generally, it was always thought of in terms of the secret speech, the admission of Stalin's crimes against innocent victims of political repression, and then the fact that these kind of political prisoners came back. I guess it was really as I started doing research in the archives, I started thinking about the Gulag return as being something slightly broader than that. And I was working through Molotov's personal fond, and I was looking at letters that had been written to him in the 1950s. I guess I was particularly looking at that stage, I was starting to look at responses to the secret speech in 56, but I also found letters which had been written by ordinary Soviet citizens in 1953, just after Stalin's death. And I found this one letter, which for me is one of those kind of, I guess, exciting moments when you find something in the archives which just really changes the way you think about a particular topic. And it was a letter from a female tram driver in Moscow. And it's a very, very rich letter in which she expresses kind of her concern about the Gulag returnees, this first wave that had happened with the amnesty in 1953, and her really kind of graphic language about how she wants to have the fingers of their hands chopped off so that everyone can see straight away that this is a villain. And the fact that, you know, the political leaders, they just need to come and talk to the tram drivers of Moscow, and then they'll understand the real problems that are hitting the country. And that just sort of opened my eyes, I guess, to two things. One was obviously the fact that the return is not just about political prisoners, but about a whole raft of other kinds of prisoners as well. And secondly, this kind of anxiety and this fear that at least some citizens expressed in the 50s about the breakdown of law and order within society. And so that was a very different kind of way of people responding to the return and to the Thaw period generally, which wasn't just about kind of relief that the terror was over, but also some kind of other perhaps less positive emotions as well.
Yeah, one of the things that's very interesting about your book is your source material, the fact that you use a lot of letters and petitions from regular citizens to the government. Talk a bit about these sources. In particular, what do they tell us about public opinion and identity in Soviet Russia? And then also, what kind of methodological challenges did they pose for you?
I mean, I think they're an incredibly rich source, but they are also a problematic source in various ways. The kinds of sources that I found most useful and interesting were two different kinds of letters, I guess. One was petition letters, so when people write to the authorities because they want something to happen, something concrete and good to happen to them, in kind of area that I was working on, that was particularly letters from people wanting either release from the camps or rehabilitation or the restoration of property that had been confiscated. So something concrete like that. The other kind of letter that people wrote were letters where people had nothing material to gain from it, but they just wanted to express an opinion. And the way that I found that kind of particularly interesting, that kind of engagement of ordinary citizens with the political authorities, that they think that they've got something important to say. And the fact that they think somebody cares, that they think somebody in the Politburo is going to be reading their letters and might even change their policies and the direction the country's taking, if only they know what the ordinary citizen thinks. So I find that kind of interesting as a reflection on how at least some people thought about Soviet power. I mean, the real problem, of course, with these kind of letters is always the question that's raised is how typical are they? How representative are they of some kind of broader popular opinion? And that's obviously difficult because the very fact that somebody's written a letter perhaps makes them atypical. If you think even about contemporary society, you know, people who write letters to newspapers are perhaps unusual. Most citizens, most people, I guess, might moan about something but can't actually be bothered to take that step of writing the letter. So in a way, that's, you know, they are perhaps people who are in some ways exceptional, but I don't necessarily think that makes them unuseful to us as historians. So the way that I started thinking about letters to the authorities was that people in expressing their ideas, they get their ideas, they get their language from somewhere. And what I was interested in looking at was, where do their ideas and vocabularies mirror the kind of rhetoric that you find in the official Soviet press, and where does it diverge? And if it diverges, does it diverge in very idiosyncratic ways which are unique just to them, or can we find certain patterns in the way that they're diverging? And if so, where do those patterns come from? Is there some kind of oral culture existing which is obviously influenced by Soviet official rhetoric but isn't necessarily a kind of a mirror image of it or a direct reflection of it?
Through letters, you know, the question is how typical are they is always an issue. But in some ways, you know, a lot of letters tend to repeat the same types of narrative structures, the same types of issues, the same types of concerns. So that gives you a better sense that, you know, maybe they might be representative of a wider opinion amongst the public.
Yeah, right. So if you start to see these kind of patterns emerging, then I think that you can start to say something tentative, or but you can start to say something about what you think broader public opinion might be. And the other thing that I thought about these letters was that, okay, so they're problematic, but they're also that they're one of the key sources of information that the Soviet regime has as well. So just as we're reliant on the letters because they're the only written source that we have which tells us about popular opinion, so too for the political leaders, for the officials who are trying to make sense of Soviet society, if they want to know what people think on a certain issue, they too use those kind of letters. So however distorted a picture of popular opinion it might be in some ways, it's also the distorted opinion, distorted picture that the authorities have to deal with as well.
Mm-hmm. No, that's something really worth taking into consideration, how these supply the government what people are thinking, and this, you know, makes them even more important for that fact. Let's move on to the substance of the book itself. Your book begins with Stalin's death on March 5th, 1953. What happens as a result?
Well, I guess there's three kind of key events that happen in March, in 1953, after Stalin's death in March of that year. One of the first events is the amnesty, which happens about 3 weeks later. This is a decree which issues release to prisoners who are serving less than five years, and it also reduces by half the sentences people are serving if it's over 5 years, with some exceptions. And as a result, almost 50% of the Gulag population is released over the course of the next year or so. So it's a very rapid reduction in the size of the prison camp population, and leads to this kind of very significant exodus of prisoners from the camps. So that's one of the major events. The other two things that I guess I talk about in the book are also the release of the doctors who'd been arrested as part of the doctors' plot of January 1953. This was kind of is often seen as the height of post-war repressions and the anti-Semitic, wave of anti-Semitism in which the Soviet government was engaged in the final years of Stalin's rule. And in April of 1953, again, very soon after Stalin's death, there's a public admission that the doctors weren't guilty and that they too are released. And then by the summer of 1953, Beria, it is also head of the secret police, is also released, and released, he's arrested. So what we see there is a kind of a shift. There's signs which I think are quite visible that something is changing in Soviet society, that something about the Stalinist system is going to change quite rapidly. These changes, the amnesty, the release of the doctors, the arrest of Beria, it's all talked about in the Soviet press. And yet it's talked about in a way that doesn't necessarily help people make sense of it very well. These stories are reported, but there isn't yet a really explicit explanation of why and how things are going to change. And I think that's what makes 1953 a problematic year for people, because they must be aware that there is a change in direction after Stalin's death. But exactly the nature of that shift isn't clear, I think, either in 53 or 54 or 55. I think it's only once we get to 1956 and the secret speech, that you even see the political leaders trying to explain to people what's going on and the nature of the changes that were following Stalin's death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the interesting threads that goes through your work is that 53 in Stalin's death and then these immediate changes creates a lot of confusion in Soviet society. People don't know the calculus of how to conduct oneself and what the rules are changes, and people are kind of lost and are trying to make sense of all of this.
Yeah, and I think that's true for the ordinary citizen who doesn't necessarily have a direct experience of the Gulag, him or herself. I think it's also true of people who were either prisoners or who'd been released and wanted rehabilitation, that again, that they're aware that something's changing. For some people, that will be a positive thing if they're people who are hoping for release or rehabilitation. For other people, as I've suggested already, you know, it might be not wholly positive experience. But I think for all people, it's confusing trying to work out how to express their ideas now. Now, you know, if we use Stephen Kotkin's terms, the kind of ideas of speaking Bolshevik, I think people in writing petition letters, for example, would try and speak Bolshevik, but it's not necessarily clear anymore exactly what that is. And I think by the time we get to 1956 with the secret speech, that's an attempt to bring some clarity. But I'm not sure that clarity is achieved even in 1956. I think the secret speech, in part because of its ambiguous status, this kind of document which lots of people know about but isn't published, and I think also because it's a long and quite confusing document itself, I think as a result of that, the confusion that I found in 1953 doesn't dissipate by 1956. And I think this is an ongoing feature of the 1950s, is that something is changing, but exactly what it is and how people are now supposed to articulate or express themselves, it is not kind of resolved. And I think that's something that is ongoing through really kind of perhaps throughout the whole of the Khrushchev period, perhaps starts to change a little bit by the 1960s.
One of the things you focus on, I mean, first you have this mass amnesty, but there's still people left in the gulag. So what the amnesty actually opens up is the possibility for people to either petition for their release or for those who are released to petition for their rehabilitation for past crimes. In what ways did gulag inmates or former gulag inmates represent themselves in these petitions, and what kind of narrative forms did they use to use your words, craft the perfect petition?
Well, I think there's different choices open to people, and I think there is a difference here between how political prisoners would try and articulate their narrative and those of non-politicals. One way is for people to try and say, to admit that they'd made mistakes, to say, okay, so perhaps I did go AWOL when I should have been serving in the army, perhaps I did steal something from the collective farm. But they can, in a sense, kind of employ a kind of socialist realist narrative, which is to say, okay, I made a mistake when I was young. I was young and uneducated. Often people would talk about the poor upbringing they'd had. They talk about the fact that during the war they'd not had a good Soviet family. They'd perhaps not even had an education in a Soviet school, but it had ended up, for whatever reason, roaming across the Soviet Union as an orphan, one of these kind of беспризорники. And so they were trying to say, well, all this happened, I made mistakes, but I have been corrected almost by the time my time within the Gulag, and I can now be a good Soviet citizen. I now want to come back into society, come back onto the correct path in life, and I'm ready to do that. The other possibility for people, and this, I guess, was particularly political prisoners, was rather different. They didn't, as people who were innocent of any political crime, what they wanted to show was not that they'd made mistakes and had been corrected, but in fact that they'd been truthful all along, that they had in fact been honourable, loyal party members throughout their time in prison and in the camps. And in a way, what many of them wanted to show was, if anything, their experience of suffering and trauma had just made them stronger and better Bolsheviks. So it's a way of kind of reaffirming their party loyalty. And one of the things that I suggest in the book is that these narratives are quite powerful, and they also themselves feed into the secret speech that Khrushchev makes in 1956, that this idea of the incredibly devoted, martyr-like party member who suffers in the camps and then comes back ready to serve the party anew, in a way, is a kind of motif that is quite useful for the party, because it says that the terror and this admission of everything that's gone wrong doesn't necessarily have to be really damaging and difficult for the regime. Actually, it can be a source of renewal, because by showing this, we can show that the party is honourable and can, in a sense, come back to life again now.
Yeah, let's turn to the secret speech a little bit more, because as you said, up until 1956, there are very few guidelines as to, you know, to fix the confusion after Stalin's death and the ways the regime is changing. And Khrushchev's speech tries to give some kind of sense, in some way, a new narrative. And I think your discussion of how it tries to reconfigure people who were sent to Gulag were now kind of heroes, and it tested them and made them better Bolsheviks. But how did Soviet citizens interpret the secret speech? Because as we know, it wasn't that secret. And in particular, Khrushchev's attack on the concept of enemy of the people. And then second, did party members have different views than the general public on what Khrushchev was saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, I'm not the first person to have said this. Quite a few scholars in recent years have started to look at reactions to the secret speech. And very much, of course, what comes across is the fact that it's a very badly kept secret. The problematic nature of it is that it's not a secret, but the exact contents of the speech isn't widely distributed. It's read out to party members, but it's not published in the press. So lots of people will have some inkling of its content, but they won't know exactly. And so there's a lot of curiosity about that, but there's also a lot of anger from people who are saying, well, why can't we know what's in it? And I guess a kind of demands for greater honesty from the government. There's also a sense from some people, again, that the government needs to know more about what ordinary people think. So kind of saying, you need to open up some kind of system or institute of popular opinion so that you can actually find out properly what people think, what the ordinary people are making of this. And we have this new wave of letter writing of people feeling that they know something's happening, they want the government to know their reactions to it. The reactions to it, I guess, are really mixed. In terms of the revelations about the terror itself, some people think that they don't need to have any new information. So some people, including some party members, is to say, well, actually, at the end of the terror in 1938, as the terror was drawing to a close, there was an admission then by the party leadership that errors had been made. So, yep, we dealt with it then. We really don't need to come back to it now. But that's not necessarily a universal feeling. Other people felt that they did want to talk about it. And some people buy into this idea that talking about the terror, admitting the mistakes, can be part of some kind of revival of the party and of Bolshevism. And I think perhaps that's most common amongst people who were more committed party members, perhaps people who were involved in the writers' union, the writers' circles, people who have perhaps had more direct experience of the terror, have known people who've been arrested. And they, in particular, might be people who want to see the rights of political victims restored as of the party. But as I said before, I think kind of the secret speech is in many ways quite a confusing speech, because it also, as well as admitting to the arrest of people, innocent victims of the terror, it also does other things. One of the other things that it does is it criticises Stalin, but again in quite a subtle way. Rather than saying, well, I guess in the past, people, political leaders, once party leaders, once they'd been rejected, it would be that they were, you know, unmasked as an enemy. What Khrushchev's trying to do is something really quite different in terms of speaking about Stalin and trying to give a much more mixed picture, saying Stalin was very good for the country in certain respects. He was very bad in other ways. And I think this kind of mixed message is difficult, because people are saying, well, we want a clear message. For example, people are concerned about the portraits of Stalin that are ubiquitous in the Soviet Union. What are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to carry on having a portrait on the wall of Stalin or not? And so I think that kind of unclear message from Khrushchev confuses people, and partly because people have to make a decision. You know, if you've got a portrait of Stalin in your office, you actually have to make a decision about whether to keep it there or not. And you, there's obviously an anxiety. If you make the wrong decision, then you could be committing a political error yourself. And I think people find it difficult, this idea that political figures can be mixed. And we see a kind of, a resurgence of the language of enemies quite often happening. Some people kind of suggesting that Khrushchev himself might be an enemy, because in a way this language, this rhetoric of enemies, I think, is quite embedded. And I think Khrushchev's criticism of it, he talks about kind of the concept of the enemy of the people being something that Stalin invents. I don't think he can get rid of this kind of language quite so easily as he might have imagined.
Yeah, the ambiguous portrait of Stalin that he paints, I mean, you can see the vestiges of this in Russian society today. I mean, people still are kind of caught with, how do we deal with Stalin? There are people who are just complete condemnation, and there are people who, you know, still kind of hail Stalin as a great hero and savior of the country. But even the Putin regime, the Putin government, tries to walk a kind of thin line between not completely condemning but not completely advocating Stalin. So it's interesting that Khrushchev, the narrative that Khrushchev put forward in 1956, I mean, really continues today in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and the problems with that, as you say, yeah.
4 million prisoners are released from the Gulag between 1953 and 1958. Tell us about, first, the reaction to this mass wave of people who have been branded as enemies and as criminals. How does society kind of deal with this? How do they accept it or view it? And then talk about the difficulties of returnees themselves and their efforts to reintegrate themselves back into Soviet society.
I guess always the problem in talking about reactions, it comes back to the issue of sources that we were discussing a little bit earlier. A lot of the sources that I came across were letters from people who were extremely concerned about the return of prisoners. This isn't to say that everyone was concerned. Some people, I guess, you know, would obviously be, this would be a great moment, their loved one is finally returning. And I think those stories, you know, we shouldn't forget about those, that some people came from the camps, did have a family to return to, and this was, you know, a really, really important moment in their lives. And lots of people had a sense of gratitude to Khrushchev for that. But that's not the kind of, I guess, the kind of universal story. In terms of reactions, the letters that citizens wrote suggest that there was anxiety about Gulag returnees, and I guess perhaps more than anxiety, in a sense, as anger, that these people who they saw as being criminals could come back into Soviet society and potentially commit crime. So there's a real anxiety about criminal activity, I think, from the summer of 1953 onwards. There's a real sense of rumours within society that perhaps the problem of crime isn't really as big as people feared, but these rumours that criminals, murderers, rapists are marauding both the city streets and Moscow's trams and the railways and so on. I think those fears are very real, and this is something that from the summer of 1953 onwards the party leadership is very aware of. And they even talk in early 1954 about the need to have newspaper articles reassuring people that criminals are being properly dealt. So in early 1954, there's this kind of commission of very high-ranking party members and members of the Soviet government who are basically discussing the fact that they need a murderer sentenced to death headline, and they're trying to work out how they can kind of manage that and how they can produce that. And it's a realization that, and they talk about this openly, even when there isn't necessarily a rise in crime in particular regions, there is a rise in that anxiety about crime. And people talk about things that they can see around, and they talk about groups of men gathering, playing cards, drinking, involved, getting into fights. And these things are seen, and perhaps the rumours of them are exaggerated, but there is that kind of anxiety about what the Gulag returnees bring with them. In terms of the experience of returnees, again, I mean, there are obviously lots of people who, in a way, never appear in the archives. They return from the camps and presumably find work and get on with an ordinary life. But the people who are, of course, as a concern and therefore kind of leave a historical record are those who don't manage to return and integrate as they might have wished into Soviet society. There's real problems with employment. The Soviet and the government in Moscow is kind of saying to employees, well, you need to take on Gulag returnees and find them work. But actually on the ground, factories, enterprises are often reluctant. So there are many stories of returnees who come back. They don't necessarily have a home to go back to. They're trying to lodge with kind of relatives or friends and find work, and that's difficult. And so what you find is that some returnees end up living a quite transient lifestyle. Some people kind of people talk about the rise of vagrants on at stations and on railways, people who haven't been able to kind of reintegrate well back into society. And there's one story that I found in the archives which just really struck me, which was the case of a man who'd come back from the camps, and he was living with a sister who wasn't really that happy to have him staying there. And he was trying to find work and he couldn't find work. And then his sister kept on, got more and more angry with him. And in the end, as a kind of act of desperation, he ended up going and writing an anti-Soviet pamphlet or kind of leaflet and sticking it to the wall of the local KGB office. His intention, it seems to be clear from the court case which followed, was simply to get sent back to the Gulag, because he didn't know how to make a life for himself in Soviet society. And I'm sure that kind of story is absolutely atypical, but I think it is representative of some of the problems which former prisoners encountered.
One of the things that you talk about that people in society are concerned with Gulag returnees is the effects and influence of Gulag subculture. Talk a little bit about what exactly is Gulag subculture.
I think the ways that Gulag subculture kind of might manifest itself are, for example, in the form of tattoos on prisoners' bodies, songs that they might sing, the language, particular slang words, which are kind of unique to the camps and to the prison subculture. Now, of course, this isn't to say that everyone who's been inside one of the prison camps is affected by this, but I think there is a sense that there some returnees bring with them elements of this this subculture when they come back into Soviet society. So again, some of the cases that I look at in the book involve people who were rearrested in the 1950s. What I found particularly interesting was cases of men, and they were particularly men, not exclusively, who came back having served a sentence for a non-political crime. So they're people who had been in camps for theft or hooliganism or something like that. And they come back and they find themselves rearrested in the mid to late 1950s, but this time as a political prisoner. And one of the things that they're accused of in several of these cases is the fact that they've brought back with them songs or ideas that they're then kind of disseminating in society. So there's one case of a youngish man who comes back. I think he's only about 20, and he starts teaching his friend who works at the same factory as him, songs that he'd learned in the camps. And what we find is both of the two men, really young men, end up with prison sentences for engaging in kind of anti-Soviet political activity.
You focus on the ways the state and society dealt with this crime wave. And one of the ways is the state began to appeal to society or to this concept of a Shestvenost in policing society. Can you talk a little bit about the ways citizens participated in fighting crime?
So I guess one of the kind of general ideas in the 1950s and under Khrushchev was the idea that Soviet society was progressing to the next stage of the revolution. So it was moving towards the communist future. And as we know, in the communist future, there's no longer going to be need for a state. And the state's eventually going to wither away, and society will fulfil what were once the functions of the state for themselves. So in lots of different ways, we see the Khrushchev era government trying to engage members of Soviet society in various tasks which had once been fulfilled by the state and its own structures. And one of these is, in a sense, in dealing with offenders. There are various different ways that people can get involved in fighting against crime and trying to kind of maintain law and order in society. So one thing that people can do if they want to is to join brigades, voluntary brigades, which patrol city and village streets and try and prevent crime happening. The other kind of activity they might be involved in is comrades' courts. So comrades' courts are normally based at a workplace, though they can also be a housing block as well. And so the idea is, when we're talking about crimes which are, I guess, relatively minor, that people can be tried by their peers rather than in a state court. And I guess the notion is that somehow the shame of being judged by your members of society is going to be much more effective in making people really reflect on their behaviour and make them want to change. What I found interesting about this was kind of also a shift that I think happens over the course of the 1950s, is that throughout the 1950s there's very strong, after Stalin's death, really a strong emphasis on these kind of collective policing ideas. A lot of these ideas aren't in themselves new, that they've been there in earlier kind of incarnations, particularly in the earlier Stalinist period in the 1920s. But they've perhaps kind of fallen into abeyance, and they've, you know, really revived in the 1950s. A lot of talk about them in the press and the importance of them. But there's also this shift that we see over the course of the 1950s, which is certainly by 1959, right at the end of the decade, we see a real stress on the idea that crime can disappear from society. And again, I think this is to do with the ideas of the communist future being near. That no longer kind of brigades just about arresting people who've already committed offences, but that they can in a way kind of prevent the crime happening itself by being constantly engaged in this kind of moral re-education of people. So in a way, it's all about trying to prevent criminality happening at all. I guess it's also about trying to reduce the prison camp population. So particularly, again, by the end of the 1950s, there are moves to say that people who have committed sentences, committed offences, but not particularly serious ones, shouldn't be sent to the gulag, but instead should be kind of corrected within society, and that they should be kind of handed over to an organisation, normally their workplace, for their kind of guardianship, so that the kind of the workplace normally would become a guardian of this person, and it would be their responsibility to kind of be closely monitoring that person and prevent them kind of sliding back into a criminal lifestyle. So I guess keeping an eye that they are behaving themselves, that they're not drinking, that they're coming to work and all those sorts of things. So there's this idea that criminality can be, you know, soon will be a thing of the past, and it's the collective responsibility to try and make that happen.
But yet again, the year 1961 is yet another turning point in your story. On the one hand, Stalin's body is removed from the mausoleum. He's publicly denounced in the press. His victims are exonerated. But on the other hand, Khrushchev returns to a rhetoric reminiscent almost of the 1930s in speaking about socially dangerous elements in society and calls for, I quote, a battle against idlers and parasites, hooligans and drunkards. And he states that there is no place for these weeds in our life. How do you explain this contradiction between denouncing repression on the one hand, but seemingly calling for its revival or renewal on another?
Well, this is a moment that I found really, really interesting, because I think I mentioned earlier in the interview about this kind of sense of confusion that I think has been really prevalent throughout the 1950s. this sense that the Khrushchev and the party leadership are saying that Stalin did bad things, that there was the repression of innocent people in the particularly in the 1930s, but also in the post-war period, and that we must kind of build a better future thing. But it's all quite unclear, I think, in the 1950s, exactly what's meant by all that, exactly how they should think about Stalin, exactly who's responsible for the terror. And all of the conversations that are happening about that are kind of cloaked in some way that, as we've said before, the secret speech doesn't get publicly disseminated. And so 1961 seems a moment, and it's often seen as being the kind of like the high point of the Khrushchev era, where the materials from the 22nd Party Congress are made public, and now a very clear message is sent out that Stalin's responsible for the terror, but also that he was supported in that by the people who are now kind of identified as members of the anti-party group, so Molotov, Kaganovich, and so on, and Malenkov. And so it's kind of seen, a clearer narrative in a way that kind of Stalin's the main guy responsible, but also that he was helped in this by kind of his closest colleagues. And so you start to see some kind of attempt at clearer narrative emerging. And obviously there's still problems with that narrative, even about the purges, and there'll be challenges to it. And we see that particularly in the literature of the early and mid-1960s. But I saw that as being kind of like a really clear attempt to resolve at least some of the uncertainties of the 50s. But as you say, at the same time, there is a shift and the Gulag population starts to climb again. And I guess what I think Khrushchev is trying to do there, in a way it's all about this idea of reviving the eschatological kind of nature of the communist project and really saying, we are moving to the future. Rejecting the errors of the past is all part of this kind of forward motion and this kind of acceleration towards the communist future. But if we're going to have that, if we're going to be able to build the communist society, then there can be no place in that for idlers and weeds. And so you kind of get this rhetoric of parasite, get out of Moscow, get out of Leningrad. So trying to kind of purify, and I guess that's the way I would think about the commonality between these two seemingly contradictory ideas is in the kind of concept of purification, that Khrushchev's saying we can purify ourselves by getting rid of and admitting to the errors of the past, but we can also purify ourselves by getting rid of those blemishes in society which are still preventing us moving forward towards communism.
That's interesting concept of purification. That's quite a novel idea. Now, how did society? I mean, you talked about how you have elements in society participating in trying to keep law and order. How did they react for this call for tougher measures against criminal elements?
Well, I think very much it's something that some people within society have been calling for several years. So I think in some ways we would expect kind of this to be well received. And I think that's the case. And you see that in kind of responses to the 22nd Party Congress, in particular to the moral code, which is kind of adopted at that point, which also talks about kind of intolerance towards parasites and so on. But I think there are also people who find this problematic as well. I mean, one group of people who find this problematic are, of course, prisoners themselves. And what I found really interesting was that some prisoners are actually very articulate, including kind of non-political prisoners. They're very articulate about the fact that they understand and they see the shift in rhetoric and priorities that has happened, and they're very unhappy about it because they understand the path and the promise of salvation and re-education, all these things that have been promised. Promised to them in the course of the 1950s is now being denied and taken away. And I think there are also people who, for example, in the final chapter of the book, I look at the case of Josef Brodsky, and who is also denounced as being a parasite himself. And some people start to understand that the pledge that the post-Stalinist leadership had made to the concept of legality. And this had also been a kind of key theme running through the 1950s as well, that the Stalin era had been seen an abuse of legality, zakonnost. And from 53, again in 56, kind of this idea that the Communist Party is now committed to obeying its own laws and being legal in its actions, that there is concern from some people, particularly other intellectuals and writers, that the campaign against bad behaviour, as it's seen, against parasites, actually is in itself a kind of betrayal of the concept of legality, which had once seemed so important to the post-Stalin regime.
You do end your book with this discussion of reactions to the publication of Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich in 1962 and the trial of the poet, as you mentioned, Yusuf Brodsky in 1964. Talk a little bit more about the importance of these two cases and how people responded to them, and also in particular the tone that they set for the final years of the Khrushchev period.
I guess thinking that back now to kind of the process of doing the research for the book, I started off early on in this interview talking about a letter that had really kind of struck me early on in the process of doing the research, the letter of the tram driver. The other kind of research, which I actually did very, very early on, was the work on responses to Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And again, found very exciting and stimulating as a process, I guess because I found something that at that point I wasn't looking for. And what I found in many of the letters to the editors of Novy Mir, the journal where Solzhenitsyn's novella was first published, was that people were very concerned about the language that Solzhenitsyn was using. They were concerned about the fact that he was using bad language, camp slang, and they saw this as being antithetical to the norms of Soviet literature. And I guess this kind of brings us back to your question earlier about subculture and the way people were hostile to the introduction of elements of this Gulag subculture into the canon of Soviet literature. And for me, again, it's, when I was doing this research, it was very much, it wasn't something that I was looking for at that stage, but it just really struck me was that what I had expected in starting to look at letters to Solzhenitsyn was that people would be talking about terror and they would be talking about the nature of the prison camps. And of course there is that there too, and I'm not saying there isn't at all, but I was also really struck by the fact that it also became a discussion about respectability, about the moral norms of both Soviet society and Soviet literature. And for me, that was a real kind of eye-opener again in terms of thinking about the fact that the Gulag return was not just about political prisoners, and it wasn't just about the political repressions and Stalin's kind of role in all of this, but it was also about this kind of these social relationships between Soviet society and the Gulag as a kind of zone which had emerged with its own identity, and for many people, a kind of an identity of which they were very fearful.
Well, it is a great book, and I do recommend that everybody go out and read it. Just to kind of wrap up the interview, the final question I ask everyone, so what are you working on now?
Well, I've just started on a new project that's fairly early days yet, but I'm interested in looking at evangelical Christianity in the post-war period, so looking at at the moment, I think a fairly long period from 45 until the end of the Soviet Union, and looking particularly at Baptists and Pentecostalists in Soviet society. It's quite different from what I've worked on before, but I guess it brings in certain elements which are shared in terms of thinking about people's beliefs and how they respond to various changes in late Soviet society. I'm hoping to do some more history interviews. At the moment, I've just started working in the archives and been looking at some fascinating cases from the 50s and 60s, looking at anti-religious propaganda, which was accused believers to the ritual killing of children. And then what I've been managing to do is to kind of find some of the court cases behind those stories and trying to look at both the kind of the real story of the believer who kind of gets caught up in this web of accusations and the kind of newspaper coverage itself.
Oh, it sounds fascinating. I really look forward to this because religious belief is something that that has yet to really been delved into when it comes to the Soviet period. A lot of work has been done on anti-religious stuff, but on what people actually believed and how they worshipped is an open field. So it's really great. So, well, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for the interview. It was wonderful talking to you.
Oh, thank you for interviewing me.
We've been speaking with Professor Miriam Dobson about her book, Khrushchev's Cold Summer, Gulag Returnees, Crime, and the Fate of Reform After Stalin. I hope you enjoy the interview. Once again, I'm Sean Guillory, your host for New Books in Russian-Eurasian Studies. If you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com. And be sure to tune in next week when New Books in Russian-Eurasian Studies talks to Thomas Duval about his book, The Caucasus and Introduction. Until then, goodbye.
Оттого-то знать не весел дом, в котором мы живем, надо бы лампочку повесить. Денег все не соберем.